Hello and welcome to the Crisis Point podcast. I'm Eric Sammons, your host and the editor-in-chief of Crisis Magazine. Be sure to like and subscribe however you're watching or viewing this. We'd really appreciate it and tell others about it. Today we have a great guest, Jason Jones. Jason Jones, okay, if I read his bio, it would be the whole podcast, so I'm just going to keep it to the short version. He is a film producer, author, activist, and human rights worker. For the past 20 plus years, he's worked to defend the most vulnerable, from the homeless on the streets of Los Angeles to persecuted Christians in Africa, from women in crisis pregnancies to victims of honor killing in Iran. He attended the University of Hawaii with a tour serving in the U.S. infantry. So I'll cut it right there. There's a lot more, though. I would say that Jason, I call him a defender of the defenseless. I have a picture of you, Jason, as a kid. You were the guy, when a bully's picking on a little kid, you went up to the bully and said, knock it off. I mean, that's how I picture you with the work that you do now, is you're basically trying to tell all the bullies of the world, knock it off. Stop picking on these different groups that can't defend themselves, from the unborn to Muslims in China, all over the world. And it's great work. So it's great to have you on, Jason. Thanks so much for coming.
Eric, it's great to be on your show. You know, my bio I would use for me, Jason Jones, is just high school dropout and teen parent from the south side of Chicago.
Yeah, well,
that's me.
Yeah, but look at the great work you're doing. God calls us all. God calls us all, no matter what our backgrounds are. So that's great. Okay, so Jason does a lot of work, and so we're trying to focus on different things. But I kind of wanted to use this episode a little bit to inform our listeners, our viewers, about stuff that's going on in the world that I think we sometimes ignore. I know I do at times. We get focused on maybe what's happening in our own backyard, but there's a lot of stuff happening around the world that we need to be informed about as Catholics. And so I want to start with China. And just recently, I want you to talk about this, Jason. Just recently, a Catholic bishop was arrested in China, and I feel like nobody even knows about it. A Catholic bishop's arrested, that should be world news. I mean, every Catholic should know about it, but nobody knows. So why don't you tell us about what happened and kind of what it means?
Yeah, well, you know, this is in a long pattern of abuse to religious and ethnic minorities in China. There are 3 million Uyghur in concentration camps across China, being killed, having their organs harvested, forcing working in slave labor for American brands like Nike. This has been documented. In fact, even yesterday, several nations made a joint statement. The G7 has made a statement. There's been a relentless and persistent abuse against the Catholic Church in China, against Catholic laity in Hong Kong. Very prominent Catholic laymen have been disappeared. And now, most recently, an Vatican-approved bishop, his priests, and his seminarians was arrested and sent off to be re-educated. And I think, as somebody growing up in the 80s, and I was not raised with any religion. I never went to church a day in my life, but I did go to synagogues for my friends' bar mitzvahs. And I remember when a young man would be getting his bar mitzvah, there would always be a bar mitzvah for a young boy behind the iron curtain. I don't know if you ever had that privilege in those days.
No.
It was something that was very interesting and beautiful. And I do know now, as an adult convert to Catholicism, I look back and I see how active the church was and how courageous someone like, for example, Bishop Fulton Sheen, on his nationally televised show, would be railing against the abuse of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union against Christians. And to think that there's nothing but total silence against the arrest of a bishop in China. But it shouldn't shock us. I mean, our church was silent as a church mouse when ISIS marauded its way across the most ancient Catholic homeland. A lot of Catholics don't understand that Iraq is really our holy land. Iraq is the home to the oldest Catholic communities in the world. I've been to churches in Iraq where they've been celebrating mass there since the first century. I've been to a church in Iraq. There have only been two buildings on the site, one built by St. Thomas that burned down in 1100 AD, and the new church. They call it the new church. And I think William the Conqueror his heart was still beating when that church was being built. And we were silent. And it is really a grave scandal. What attracted me as a young atheist to the Catholic Church was its anthropology, its explanation for human dignity, and the heroic witnesses of the Catholic saints. And so the silence right now, to me, And I think it's connected to the abuse crisis, which, by the way, I mean, Crisis Magazine was heroic in its courage on that. I think there's a connection. It is really a thoughtfulness, a thoughtlessness to the vulnerable, and cowardice to stand up with to people with quote unquote prestige or power or influence, which doesn't impress me at all. But we're falling down again. The church is really falling down again. But I will say, the hierarchy is falling down. Like, even with my work with the Uyghur, the Uyghurs will write me from all over the world. I think on my podcast, The Jason Jones Show, I have listeners in almost every country in the world. I think most of them are just Uyghurs in the diaspora, because I get all these messages from Uyghurs. And they say that the lay Catholics are the only people they see in the world really aggressively standing with them in country after country. It's the lay Catholics who are pushing for the Uyghur. Now I would like to see our hierarchy look to the example of lay Catholics and order themselves into the service of the vulnerable.
Yeah, so you bring up the Uyghurs. Uyghur Muslims in China. I mean, they're not in only in China now, because they've obviously been going other places in the world. But they've been persecuted greatly in China. And we don't really hear an uproar from, definitely not from the Vatican or from hardly any quarter of the world. And the same thing with this, the bishop who gets arrested. And just like, the question is, why? What is it that's keeping the Vatican silent when it comes to China, particularly China? I mean, they I know they've had deals and different things like that, but can you explain why you think that the church, the Vatican's been very silent about the atrocities that go on in China, and have not stood up to, doesn't seem to me at least, that they stood up at all to the Chinese government?
I mean, not at all. So there's this secret deal between the Vatican and the CCP. And I believe that secret deal, it came with a muzzle that the church placed, you know, that they've muzzled our bishops, and in exchange for money. I believe that. I think we will learn this to be true.
And so these are straight up just money that the CCP is basically funneling in some way money to the Vatican in exchange for their silence about what's going on over there.
I mean, the Vatican, it's either money or ideology. So you have the, I don't know what else it could possibly be.
Yeah, because I don't see on the surface what the Vatican benefits from staying silent on the surface. Like, I don't see how it benefits. So you're right. It's like, is it ideological? I mean, it could be ideological in the sense that, I mean, they have said things, Vatican officials, I think the Pope himself even said things that make it sound like they think the Communist Party in China is a, what was it John Zmerich said, like that's the
Toronto said it's, quote, the perfect example of, or the best example of Catholic social teaching.
Right, the best example of Catholic social teaching, which is harsh, but truth, yeah.
The enslavement of ethnic and religious minorities, yeah. Communism. I mean, this is bizarre. So it is either ideology, and I'm sure it's a little bit of both.
Right. But getting something. They have to be getting something. Otherwise, what's the point of it? And so this bishop who's arrested now, correct me if I'm wrong, but he's not like it was an underground bishop, right?
No. Yeah. This is a Vatican approved bishop. You know, it's natural. Our Lord says, you know, in scripture, we're told to love our enemy. It's natural to love one's own. So maybe it's natural not to have an affinity or have courage for the Uyghur. Someone, you know, I've had... You know, Rene Girard said that when you stand in solidarity with the vulnerable, to the mob, you become indistinguishable from the scapegoat. So they attack you with such viciousness. I love when I walk around Capitol Hill, which I've been doing this week, and meeting with, you know, influential, powerful people in the city. And they go, "We know Jason, the Uyghur." And I love that when they look at me, they think the word Uyghur, because for many of them, they never heard of the Uyghur. Right. Before my organization met with them. So I understand it may not be natural for most people. And it's maybe it does, there is some sorts of strange do-gooderism that we reject, that I reject, gallivant around the world looking for oppressed people to be the great white hope for.
Right.
So I understand that. But to be silent when your own bishop,
right?
You're Pope, you're the shepherd, you're the father. You're the father, you're his father. What would you do if your son was or apprehended and sent off to a gulag in China.
Right. You wouldn't shut me up.
You wouldn't shut up, right? Forever, for the rest of your life. I do everything I do is because it was when I was 17 years old, my high school girlfriend's father, and I was in basic training, dragged her off to have a forced third trimester abortion. I haven't shut up about abortion since that day, not a single day, probably not a 10-minute span of time has not gone by where I've not thought about abortion since that day. Right. And guaranteed not one day has gone by since that day in 1989 where I have not talked about abortion, period, and worked day after day to have a bigger audience to hear what I'm saying about abortion. And so to think, you know, in the weeks after this happened, it's still crickets. You know, what was really just too much for me is I wanted to see what Bishop Barron, I was hoping Bishop Barron would say something about this. And I went to his platform. And the days after this story broke, Bishop Barron rushed to YouTube to sing Bob Dylan a song. And it really just struck me as so bizarre, so loveless. And I thought, has the entire Catholic Church in the United States, we really have the culture of an affluent Jesuit, of a Jesuit high school in an affluent suburb. Right. Like, we are self-obsessed. You've got James Martin babbling on about LGBT ideology when in the CCP, you have really a structure of violence against people with same-sex attraction. Now, I'm Catholic, and this is something that we should be speaking about too. You know, structures of violence, forcing women to have abortions. Yet silence on all of this. But here at home, we're just promoting the most decadent nonsense, self-obsessed, loveless.
We're focusing on what your pronoun is. We're somebody might be offended because they use the wrong pronoun. And over in China, they're literally killing people and dragging them off to the gulag. And we don't say anything about that. And your article on Bishop Barron was very good. I'll try to remember to link to it in the show notes, because it's so true that there's such a disconnect between the reality of what's going on in the world and the world that people like Bishop Barron and Father James Martin seem to be living in. It just seems to be two different worlds. And, like Father James Martin, I mean, he's going to be concerned about make sure everybody's called by the right pronoun. But like you said, do you think the CCP in China is going to be treating people with same-sex attraction with, love and charity? I mean, of course not. And yet they don't say anything about that because for whatever reason, ideological or whatever. Let's talk a little bit, though. You mentioned the Uyghurs. Let's talk a little bit about that. I think a lot of people may have heard the term before, but they don't really understand the situation they're in and what is you're fighting for. So could you give the background of what their situation is and why it is that we should be caring about it?
Yeah, and let me share kind of basically. I think you asked earlier, there's so many sorrows in the world. Where do we begin? And so for me, it's always kind of began organically. You know, as a young infantryman on deployment, I just a few months after I got to my duty station, just a few months after the forced abortion, I remember seeing a father just kind of helpless to protect his own child. And I remember thinking, I want to spend the rest of my life. I looked in this father's eyes and I saw exactly how I was still feeling from this forced abortion. And I said, this is how I want to spend the rest of my life. I want to get in between the vulnerable and the violent. And I want to serve the vulnerable. I remember thinking, I'm an American. I'm privileged. Like, this man will never be privileged. Of course, I was a high school dropout. I was last in his class when I dropped out, but I still understood that I had some sort of incredible privilege that this father will never have. And so first I thought maybe this would mean special forces or something like that. And then I thought, no, I'm going to go out, get out of the army and go to college. And I had this vision for the nonprofit I run today. And it was in the wake of the first Gulf War where I got to know the Assyrian community and the Chaldean communities of Iraq as we led, and I was in graduate school getting my master's in military science and operational studies. And I began to see that if we invade Iraq, it's going to mean genocide. And I saw what happened with ISIS. If you could imagine, I did a radio show that I had with Human Life International at the time, Facts of Life, on September 12, 2001, where I talked about if we use this as a pretext to invade Iraq, we will fatigue, we will leave Iraq, and there will be genocides in our wake. And I saw it as clearly as I'm looking at you right now. And so to see that all unravel, well, I started working with the Assyrian community. really even leading up to before the invasion, then after the invasion, and during the invasion, then after we left, and then with the rise of ISIS. A publicist, and I started working with, I got to know the Kurds from my trip to Iraq, and a publicist had said, I would like you to meet with the prime minister in exile of East Turkestan and advance the Uyghur. And can you do for us what you're doing for the Kurds and others? I didn't really know anything about the Uyghur. And I thought, wait, really, we're not do-gooders. We're not gallivanting around the world looking for, causes to champion. This is something that my organization has been connected with for almost two decades now, this region, and it involves U.S. foreign policy. So when I met with Prime Minister Salih Hidayat, and I learned about how American corporations are profiting off of the exploitation of slave labor in Chinese-occupied East Turkestan. And I saw that we are all intimately involved in benefiting from this exploitation. That's how my organization very early on got involved with the Uyghur. At the time, I would walk around Capitol Hill and not one member of Congress had heard. I met with White House staff. I would say the word Uyghur, and from the 80s, it reminds them of another word. They would giggle and they'd say, what, has Eminem been arrested? They had no clue. So the Uyghur, to me, there's certain ethnic groups, which I personally just love. We know as Catholics, the Irish and the Poles, because of history, have just some sort of unique beauty, something very beautiful about them. And I would say the same thing I see in the Kurds, the Chaldeans, the Assyrians in Sudan, like the Nuba and the Dinka. There's something very beautiful. And the Uyghur have that. The Uyghur have just been crushed by the forces of history. They were destroying Christians up until the 14th century in the Turkish invasion, the Turkic invasions. They're a Turkic Caucasian people. In 1949, always relentlessly being invaded by China. In 1949, China occupied East Turkestan and began a campaign of ethnic cleansing that in the past 10 years has really ramped up, but there have been flourishes of violence. In 1993, I believe, there's something called the Barren Massacre. It's the only massacre that took place in the womb of mothers. China invaded East Turkestan because Xinjiang, new province, as they call it, because they were ignoring the one-child policy. They rounded up every pregnant woman they could find, dragged them to warehouses, and performed hundreds and hundreds of abortions in warehouses over the matter of a few days. The only massacre that took place in wombs. Well, what started in the womb has spread now to 3 million. So they're a beautiful people. The China propaganda machine talks about them as being radical. They're very hard to radicalize, kind of like the Nuba in Sudan that have been intermarrying for centuries. And the Nuba are impossible to radicalize. That's why Khartoum is waging a relentless campaign of ethnic cleansing against Muslims and Christians and animists that make up the Nuba. That's the Uyghur. They're really just a beautiful people. And you feel such an affinity for them, and you get to meet them in their community, like the Irish, like the Poles. History's just kind of created, like the Jews in Europe, created this like really something kind of a special gem of a community of a people. And they're really, I always say the vulnerable are not weak, right? They're strong people placed in an impossible situation. When a 16-year-old girl in a broken home who suffered physical, mental, sexual abuse staggers into a crisis pregnancy center, she needs all the help our community can give her. She's not weak, though. She's stronger than you or I. She's strong. Right. She's just placed in an impossible situation. If you throw Michael Phelps in the middle of the ocean, he's going to drown. If you put me in a bathtub, I'm okay. I live in a bathtub, right? We live in the bathtub. But there are people that have been placed in impossible situations that we need to care, starting in our own community, working with pregnancy centers. That's what we should be doing as Catholics. But we are the hegemon, and we live in a constitutional republic, and we are citizens. And one thing I have learned is we really have the ability to influence our government, influence the State Department, all of us. And so we need to make sure companies like Nike stop participating. If it costs China to keep 3 million people in concentration camps, they would let them out.
Right.
But it is a profitable arrangement. And if it costs them with their image, for example, if Pope Francis railed against the Uyghur, railed against the CCP's abuse of the Uyghur, But again, I want to be clear. It's not just the Uyghur. I mean, it's the Falun Gong. It's Christians. It's our community, Christian Catholics. They're all suffering. Ambassador Brownback, Ambassador at Large for Religious Liberty, last year when he went to China, he gave a very brave speech, and he all the dignitaries were there, and he says, "You have declared a war on religion. You will lose."
Wow.
His next day, he went to give a speech, and one person showed up. So, Ambassador Brownback, don't let that farmer persona from Kansas fool you. Right. He's a tough character. He flew to Taiwan and gave a speech there. But yeah, so there's a war against religion in China, and as Catholics, I think we are the ones, by God's grace and through the sacraments, through the examples of the saints, through our teaching, that have very clear instructions to live at the foot of the cross and to serve the vulnerable with a thoughtlessness to our own interests.
Now, what's the current status as far as like the Biden administration? Is it doing anything that's positive when it comes to China and the Uyghur situation, or is it kind of, are they ignoring it?
Well, I would say that there are people in the Biden administration that have been very courageous and are working very hard to continue advancing for the interests of the Uyghur in China. So, and Chinese occupied, that is happening. Although Biden has been clumsy and confusing. I don't know if you heard, he came out and said, "My wife is Han Chinese ethnically." And Biden came out and called, forgive me for laughing, but you know, when you're a kid, you first go to a funeral, you laugh because it makes you uncomfortable. What I'm about to say makes me very uncomfortable. He called the genocide of Uyghur a Chinese cultural norm. So now whenever my wife, does any, like she spills, another Chinese cultural norm, a glass of red wine all over my favorite shirt.
Goodness,
Chinese cultural norm. Could you imagine referring to the Holocaust in Germany as a German cultural norm?
Right.
In fact, if you look to the Holocaust, it was a shocking, because it went against everything we knew about the Germans. There was such a large Jewish community in Germany because it was the place that they fled to when there were the pogroms in the East. China, this is not a Chinese cultural norm. This is really something shocking. It's actually a socialist cultural norm, Western ideology cultural norm, the ideology that's infecting, China through the CCP. But it's most definitely not a Chinese cultural norm. The Chinese are the first victim of the CCP. In fact, my father-in-law was at the University of Pennsylvania when China fell. And his father was a very prominent businessman. They had to flee. So they all moved to the United States after China fell. And then my father-in-law, who fled, had to flee his home country when he was a college student, then died of what we now know really is the CCP virus. Very sorrowful. My mother-in-law had to, as a child, had to live in hiding because her father was a general. And for years, had to eat out of garbage cans. So the Chinese people are the first victim. And my heart is for the Chinese people. I mean, all my descendants forever will be ethnically Chinese.
That's right.
And I want to see a free China. And I want the Catholic Church to play a role in freeing China like we played a role in freeing Eastern Europe. Our destiny is together. Free China is a free world. An enslaved China is a world that's enslaved. We were told in the 90s that through NAFTA, GATT, and MFN for China, that we would see China become more like us. We've become more like them. We free China, we free the world. A prosperous China, a truly prosperous China, where all the Chinese get to participate, is a world that's prosperous. And I'm looking forward to the energy of a free China.
It's amazing the historical dichotomy, if you look at what John Paul II was doing in the 1980s to combat against communism, the spread of communism and Soviet communism, and then compare that to what the Vatican is doing today under Pope Francis with the Chinese communism. Because we know from history that JP2 was instrumental. His work was instrumental in helping to bring, I mean, there's a lot of factors, but he was the one big factor that helped bring it down. And so if you had the church today speaking out against the Communist Party of China, then, I mean, it's not just words in the wind. It would have an actual impact. It could have an actual impact on it, but there seems to be just no interest in doing that.
You know, Eric, you can't believe how much these words matter. I often feel ashamed. You know, to be blunt, I run a nonprofit. We're small. It's, you know, we're not the, I feel ashamed that we haven't built to be larger, more influential, because I get emails from all over the world. I just recently got a monthly donor. I'm going to cry like just talking about it. I couldn't believe it. I got a monthly donor. We have a large audience. You know, I don't know, with your podcast, you can see when and where people are listening, and it's really quite fascinating. Right. We have a large audience in Syria, and I got a $2 a month donor from Syria. I couldn't believe it. And I emailed the guy, and he said they don't have running water. And, you know, and a friend of mine from Syria, he's like, that's a guy's giving you $1,000 a month.
Right.
And I sent him an email and said he didn't really have to do that. His prayers would be enough. And he asked me to be gracious and respectful and pleased to allow him to do this, because he goes, you're the only person I see out there that's relentlessly speaking on our behalf. Could you imagine what it would mean, man, to these people, for Pope Francis to speak out for them, or someone like a Bishop Barron? And this is why, you know, scandal means, I'll be very clear what our strategy is going to be going on in the next 12 months with the church. Scandal means stumbling block. But, you know, my whole life has been taking a stumbling block and trying to turn it into a stepping stone.
Right.
And so we really want to kind of goad celebrity Bishop Barron into becoming the hero of these ethnic minorities, or to be silent and then to demonstrate to us clearly that he's been shackled by the Vatican, and that there is a deal, and the deal comes with enforcing silence from the church, not just in Rome, but around the world.
Is there any bishop that's spoken up about this that you know of, about the issues in China?
I mean, not in a clear and consistent way, no. No. In fact, I would say, you know, no.
Yeah.
I mean, bishops from the region, they almost get, they're silenced, right, here, though. One of the greatest coups that I think we ever pulled off is we were able to get a priest, an Iraqi Chaldean priest from Baghdad, to the presidential debate in 2016. And he got to meet with all of the candidates, and Ted Cruz and Trump, and give them all a letter. You know, when Steve Bannon was in the White House, you know, he was a big voice as a lay Catholic man for these communities. Right. And, you know, if people really knew what he did there and behind the scenes, and what he continues to do for ethnic minorities, you know, his persona has nothing to do with, you know, who he really is.
Yeah. I mean, the image he has, it's been created in the media of him, is not the one that you're painting.
No, I mean, it's funny. You know, I was on his show, and I wrote this article called "The Steve Bannon I Know" for Catholic Vote, when he was, Trump was naming him as chief of staff, and it was just, the persona's like so untrue. It's, you know, I have celebrity friends being in the film industry, and
right,
it's like there's this persona and there's who the person really is. And when I was talking to Steve about who he really is, he kind of blushed, you know, right there on live television. He's like, well, but I like the Darth Vader thing. And I think that there's a comfort when someone like Steve has lived most of his life just kind of behind the scenes, and there might be something comfortable about having a straw man that the world attacks, that you go, that's right, that's nothing to do with me, so have at it.
Right.
I mean, that's why a lot of celebrities also don't mind when the caricature of who they are is attacked, because they know it's really not who they are at all. But, you know, look, I will say this, the leaders in the service of these vulnerable communities are so often lay Catholics. But I really do want the hierarchy to be brave, but I don't think this is much different than what we've always experienced. You know, the reason, if you think about the reason we know the name Maximilian Kolbe, is because not every priest was dying in a starvation bunker, right?
Right.
The reason we know Franz Jägerstätter's name, who the whole world should see, Terrence Malick's The Hidden Life, is because, not, you know, he refused simply to say the loyalty oath to Hitler. His own bishop said, just say the oath. Right. It's because every other lay Catholic just said the oath.
Right.
We look at Bishop Rummel and his courage against and standing up for desegregation in Louisiana. Well, his own, you know, if you know this, he excommunicated all these Catholics that supported segregation. And what was the response of his community, his Catholics? They went and named the streets of all of these towns after the politicians he excommunicated for supporting segregation. Those streets still have those names.
Wow.
I'd like to see all those names turned to, like, you know, Archbishop Rummel Street or something.
Yeah, right, right.
You know, this is just the way it is. I don't think it's anything new. But sort of the scandal from the top, and then you have the age of mass communication, and we're seeing them communicate relentlessly on everything, right? So when they're communicating relentlessly on everything, when I see Bishop Barron taking time out of his day to make a highly produced video singing a song to Bob Dylan, and yet when the same week his brother Bishop's been enslaved, it is jarring,
right?
And we wouldn't have been, there wouldn't have been this environment in, you know, 1914. So, you know, the environment that we live in, we see them communicating all the time. So when they're silent, the silence is deafening. And the church's, the hierarchy's silence on these challenging issues. But Eric, let me be clear. When I'm in Latin America, the bishops and the priests speak a lot on abortion.
Is that right?
Might be an issue. But guess what they're silent on? Structural economic injustice. And in a lot of those countries, abortion is illegal. But guess what is... The people right. are living under massive structural economic injustice.
Right.
Here in America, where a high school dropout like me can produce movies, run presidential campaigns, write books, be on your show. And I was a teen parent last in my class. I have to listen relentlessly to church leadership talk about structural economic injustice. Go away. We're the empire of the culture of death. Why don't you address that? Right?
Right.
So it's like we never say the thing that's the thing in the place it's the thing.
Right.
And that's what I would like to see. I would like to see the church in Central and South America and Mexico talk about the cartels, talk about structural economic injustice. I would like the church in the United States to be heroic in standing up against the empire that is the culture of death. In many ways, we have become this evil empire. And I would like to see the Pope be the world's leader in standing up to the CCP, who, as Catholic convert Ambassador Brownback said, is waging a war on religion. And so I would expect Pope Francis to be the loudest voice in the world, proclaiming the dignity of the human person, pointing to God. And but we're not seeing that right now.
Yeah, and it's a great point you make that you see all the time where people will stand up for something supposedly, but it's really something that's, it's just acceptable. I mean, like the NBA with how it's dealing, you know, it has all these relationships with Nike. But they love to talk about Black Lives Matter and talk, which everybody's now like, that's fine. I mean, the media is, you're going to be a media darling if you do that, but they won't say one word against the slave labor in China or anything like that. The thing that actually, you know, matters right now that you need some courage to stand up to. And you see that within the church as well. Real quick, I want to talk a little bit more about your nonprofit. I assume this is Hero, right?
Hero Inc.
H-E-R-O. Mm-hmm. And so it's Human Rights Education Relief Organization. And so you're obviously doing some work with the Uyghurs. What other work is Hero doing, and what kind of stuff are you involved in with that?
So we have two programs, and the world knows us as these two programs. A lot of folks think they're two separate organizations. They're really just two programs of Hero. We keep the brands kind of separate. Movie to Movement is a program of Hero Inc. where we produce and promote movies that advance the culture of life. So I was an executive producer on Bella, worked on films like The Stoning of Soraya M. My most recent film is Divided Hearts of America, starring Benjamin Watson, who had just retired, played for the Patriots, was tight end. We look at the causes of division in America and how it's rooted in those three denials of our founding principle, which is slavery, segregation, and abortion. My favorite of our films is Crescendo. It's a short film, but I made it with Patti Millette and the mother of Justin Bieber and Eduardo Verástegui. So that's what Movie to Movement does, and allows us to punch way above our weight, right? So I show up with cameras in Iraq, or this fall, by God's grace, and if COVID rules loosen up, I'll be in Iraq, Yemen, and a few other countries in the region working on our next film. And so that's what Movie to Movement does. And then the Vulnerable People Project is another program of Hero, and our website's thegreatcampaign.org, really inspired by the words of St. John Paul the Great, that we should mobilize against the culture of death the way that we mobilized against totalitarian socialism and launch a great campaign for life. And so at thegreatcampaign.org, what we do with the Vulnerable People Project is we run influence campaigns. So for stateless ethnic and religious minorities, but also for the child in the womb, for the elderly, the sick. And so people go, it seems like you have a lot of irons in the fire. I'm like, we have one iron, defend the vulnerable from violence. And, you know, but we use books, we use speeches, we use articles, we use white papers, we use movies to advance the interests of the vulnerable. And so at the Vulnerable People Project, that's like what I'm doing now. I show up, I meet with members of Congress, we give them white papers, we say we can ghostwrite an op-ed for you and place it on this issue if that would be okay with you. And that's the part of the job I really love, because it's the part where we can see, for me, it's like making movies are huge projects that take a lot of time, but I can come to DC this week, I can get 3 op-eds placed. You know, there's just a lot you can get done. And they're both very important programs of our ultimate mission, which just is to promote the incomparable dignity, beauty, and beauty of the human person, and to inspire others to live in solidarity with the vulnerable. And I've really been influenced by Rene Girard. And so this idea that if enough people are in solidarity with the vulnerable, they cease to be vulnerable. But at very early stages of these campaigns, it takes a lot of courage. I could tell you stories, but it probably wouldn't be too prudent, of the kind of courage it takes to stand with the weaker, for example. The CCP doesn't play.
Yeah, no.
Very serious. And again, that's what makes me very skeptical about this secret Vatican deal, because McCarrick is the most, easily the most blackmailable human being that ever walked the face of the earth.
Right.
He brokered that deal. And just from my own experiences, I know how serious and aggressive they are. So, yeah, but then eventually it doesn't take any courage at all. Like today, it doesn't take any courage to say Black Lives Matter.
Right.
But, you know, go to Mississippi in 1953 and say that. Well, that would take quite some courage.
Right.
And, you know, to stand up against National Socialism in Germany today doesn't take any courage. But to land in Normandy on D1 took a lot of courage.
Right.
And so that's what we hope to be. We hope to, we don't pick battles. We want to be in D1 in every battle. We want to be in, you know, D1, not
right.
Not D. Well, you know what? I recently figured out what, you know, what day is it? No battle against National Socialism in Europe. Like, what would it be? You know, D14,732. Like, I landed in Normandy, and you know, day 14,792. Probably not a lot of courage there.
Yeah. Okay. A couple of other questions I wanted to ask before we finish, and are a little bit just. You've been talking recently, I've seen, about the Catholic Reset. And I want to ask you, what is the Catholic Reset, and what's the, you know, obviously it's a play on the Great Reset, which I think a lot of, hopefully our listeners know what that is. So what is the Catholic Reset that you're talking about?
I think we're going to see here in the United States, in the Catholic Church and around the world, a really aggressive, rapid reorientation of our teaching, especially on those teachings around sexual ethics and human life. And, you know, I fear that we might by next June see rainbow flags hanging in front of all of our parishes. And I just recently did a podcast with John Gravano and John Smirek on this. It was very interesting because we came from 3 really different places. But because just the nature of a lot of my friendships and being an adult convert to the Catholic Church, and even losing friends who I love because I'm not willing to back down on what the church teaches. What most worries me about this quote unquote Catholic reset, especially on human sexuality, is it's just not true. You know, as an adult convert, I lived a reckless life of hurting a lot of people. So the idea that it's the church is infringing on people's freedom or joy or happiness through its teachings is foolishness. That one would have to be cruel or naive or a rapacious predator to advance. So, but to me, the greatest fear I have with this Catholic reset is teaching a generation of young Catholics with same-sex attraction that they don't have to confess their mortal sins. This is really, I believe what the church teaches, right? And so the idea that they wouldn't even know, it would never even cross their mind, they would never even have an inkling of thought that they have to confess their sins, you know, that the Eucharist is right there for them, but it's right through the confessional door. And again, and you talked about how I am addled, you know, by the vulnerable. David Mamet, I, I, I travel a lot, so I'm always watching masterclasses. And my favorite one is David Mamet's masterclass, one of my favorite ones, and on dramatic writing. And he talked about, you know, writers write for the same reason beavers chew wood, because their teeth itch. And that resonated with me, because my teeth itch at the thought of people being lonely, exposed to violence, to being confused or disoriented or lost or feeling hopeless. Like, this addles me, right? Whether it's children hiding from drones in Yemen, or a young Catholic being groomed through LGBT ideology at a Jesuit school in an affluent white suburb. My heart goes out to these people. And so this is my great fear with this Catholic reset, that it's going to leave a whole new class of Catholics exposed. And it's bizarre to me. It is really someone who, look, I didn't want to convert to Catholicism. Even when I sent it to the truth of it, I would pray and I'd say, God, you know, I can't ever, I was like in my early 30s, ever live up to these rules. It's just not going to happen. And so I get that it's something that makes people think it's an obstacle. And I didn't get it. I remember I really didn't get it until I read Love and Responsibility by Carol Wojtyła. And that was jarring. That was a jarring experience to read that, because I really realized that sexuality and how we love and see the other is really intimately linked. And so I think that's another, maybe just saying that out loud. This Catholic reset is going to be inevitable, isn't it? Because we have really forgotten the other. We have really forgotten thoughtlessness. We really become thoughtless to the other. And so this Catholic reset is inevitable, isn't it? I guess.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of my big frustrations with people like Father James Martin and all the bishops who enable him, is the absolute destruction that he wreaks in the lives of young people. I mean, just destruction. Because I worked for a while, helped out with Courage, which is apostolate to people with same-sex attraction. And the stories of pain and suffering that these young men and women have, who are, you know, almost always abused, and they have these feelings of same-sex attraction. And when a priest basically just says, you know, it's all hunky dory, there's nothing wrong. And frankly, a lot of times it's a grooming situation. And it just, the destruction they have. And so when he puts a smiley face on Father James Martin on the Colbert Show or whatever, all I can think about is those young men and women who are struggling through no fault of their own. They're struggling with this, and now they see no way out. And sometimes they'll go to the church like, okay, maybe this is a solution. And the church gives them nothing. The church just basically just says, you're fine the way you are, even though they know they're not. They need healing. And they're just being told, no, you're fine. It just really is. And so it's unbelievable. Like, at least let's have a good heresy like Arianism. We have like this, just like, you know, satisfy your carnal desires heresy. It's like, come on, give us a good one.
No, I tell people, I would much rather Pope Francis invade Florence or something with his mistress and children tagging along behind.
Like, right.
Maybe something real. And, you know, but I do want to get, what really strikes me is the utter thoughtlessness to other human beings, as if they're in this, you know, if they're playing Fortnite and they're like the only, my kids are like, I don't know how old your children are. Like, they play this game Fortnite and they're these characters that are just in the game, but they're not real people.
Okay. Right.
And as if they go through life thinking they're the only real player in the game. They're the only real person in the whole universe. These aren't other human beings.
Right.
The words you say don't have real I will tell you, as a teenager, when I became sexually active as a freshman, not that I wasn't interested in women, but I wasn't raised with any religion. And, you know, my dad gave me a black book in the eighth grade, and he told me to, you know, to have it filled up. I should have it filled up. And he gave me a box of condoms and a black book in the eighth grade, you know, but so it wasn't like I was being prepared for chastity, but I wasn't really thinking of going out there. But it was when a teacher in class, in sex ed class, she made me feel, and I think she made the whole class feel, like if we weren't already sexually active, we were freaks and weirdos.
Right.
And so I'm like, I don't want to be a freak and a weirdo. So I guess I got to get the show on the road.
Right.
And this is, and then that became a lifetime of habits and behaviors that became habits. And then, you know, I look back as a man in my late 20s and a wreckage of young women who didn't get married. I wasted their time, right? And yeah, so these words have real impact in people's lives.
Right. It's awful. Okay, before we go, I have to ask a question that's kind of all this, but we talked about it beforehand was, it's my understanding that you were the first person arrested protesting COVID. And so I got to hear the story of this. There's a pretty famous picture of you being arrested. I think it was in Hawaii, and I think it was very early on during lockdowns. And so just give us the background, because I think this is just fascinating. Well, you got a lot on your resume, but this is one of the best.
Well, you and my wife, by the way, she was very proud of me. In fact, my friend had it framed, you know.
Oh, that's awesome.
Cover of my paper. I was in the front page of the Drudge, cover of the Drudge Report. Before I got out of jail, I was only in jail for 3 hours. Right. I had like 10,000 emails. You know, if you were in the inbox, be on Drudge Report in handcuffs.
Yeah, that would be a good way to
hear from old friends. You know? Right. So I'll tell you, again, I wasn't there for the First Amendment. Food security is something I think a lot about. In fact, and food security for Hawaii is something I think a lot about. In fact, I wrote my book with John Zmierich, The Race to Save Our Century, because I realized my home, my love, in many ways, my alma mater, my mother is Hawaii, the community, the people. I love the state like a person. I can't even begin to explain how much I love Hawaii. I moved there as a young 17-year-old, and it's where my nervous system was rebuilt. I got my formation. I built my friends. I found my mentors. Hawaii is everything to me. And in the mid-90s, in college studying political science and the genocides and democides and wars of the 20th century, came to realize how vulnerable Honolulu was, Oahu was, the Hawaiian Islands were, especially when it came to food. So when the shutdown happened in Italy, I came out and wrote an article saying that if the world follows Italy's lead, we will starve the world, because just the tiniest contraction in food production, processing, and distribution will lead to an epic famine. We now know that this happened and is happening. Thanks to David Beasley, who won the Nobel Prize, because he's a Trump loyalist, no one talks about this, the World Food Program, and because of the Trump administration, it wasn't nearly as horrible as it would have been. So my protest was really motivated by a thoughtfulness of Hawaii's food security. We ended up having lines 7 miles long for food. And you can YouTube these videos. They're insane. So I knew that this would lead to food insecurity in Hawaii. And it would be devastating to other vulnerable parts of the world where people were living on the edges of hunger. They would fall into hunger. Where they were in hunger, they would fall into starvation. And this is exactly what happened. And of course, you and I, Eric, and probably many of your listeners, we suffered from Zoom fatigue, which, you know, we heard a lot about. Yeah, right. So that was why I was motivated to do this protest. And how I ended up being the one they arrested is really strange, but there was a lot of people were there. The police kind of did this weird military maneuver. Me knowing what a cordon and search it looks like, I know how to break a cordon up, so I directed the crowd to move towards the police so the cordon wouldn't work in every direction. And they realized I was kind of the one that had scuttled their little tactic and led to me being arrested. But, you know, as I was being handcuffed, I was saying to the police officers, one of them was a student of mine 20 years before.
Wow.
When I taught Christology and ethics at a Catholic high school. Can you imagine this? And he handcuffed me. And I said to each of the police that they're bringing, I said their names, looked at them. It's on the videos out there. And I said their names. I said, you're bringing shame, Officer Tagawa, on your family's name for generations. Wow. Officer Johnson, you're bringing shame on your family for generations. And thank you for giving me this honor to be handcuffed for my community and blessing my posterity with this example. And, you know, they didn't know how to take it. And then I was like, telling my wife, you know, get the keys. They're in my front pocket. My family wasn't stuck there. So that's the story behind how I ended up in handcuffs.
May of 2020?
Yeah, I believe that was in May.
Okay. So very early on.
Or April even. Yeah, we started protests in April. I don't know if it was the first protest where I got arrested. Oh, by the way, there were never any charges filed.
Huh.
And I received an apology letter from the mayor.
Oh, wow.
The police, the attorney general, and the governor. And my $300 bail was returned to me. It was very strange.
Yeah.
The whole thing was very bizarre.
The whole COVID response has been theater from day one.
Yes. And
so it's not surprising. They probably saw that it didn't work for their theater to have you on the cover of Drudge and, you know, all this other stuff. And they realized, oh, this guy actually, who's a guy with a platform, we definitely don't want to tick him off too much. And yeah, I mean, the whole thing has been theater from day one.
Oh, so. Yeah, they made a mistake because right. Steve Bannon had me on. All these people were sharing it. Earlier, I had went to a COVID testing site in February. I don't know if you know about this.
No.
I had been exposed to COVID. My mother-in-law, who is elderly, lived with us. I shouldn't call her elderly. She's older than 24.
Right, yeah.
And so I thought it'd be smart to get a hotel room and get tested. I went to this COVID testing site where they did a news report that there were lines miles long. And I realized it was a movie set, that it was the news crew's staff. It was the news crew and staff pretending to be tested. And off camera, there was a woman with her mask off, like literally picking her nose. And they wouldn't let me and this very sick woman, Hawaiian woman who came to get tested, wouldn't test us. So I filmed it. And I asked people, what's going on? Well, the thing went super viral. And then Tulsi Gabbard, who was running for president, tweeted it out and said, my friend is at this testing site, can't get tested, what's going on? And so I think, yeah, they realized this was probably the wrong guy to handcuff, you know?
Yeah, right, exactly.
They picked me because I was tall, I had blonde hair and blue eyes, and it fit the narrative. And the narrative right. they wanted was, these are Haoles. Of course, the same day I was arrested, a Samoan chief was arrested with me. And I'll tell you, it was a strip club owner, it was three of us that were arrested. I'm in the back seat of this car with this guy. This tells you, you know, it's like when tyranny comes, it makes strange bedfellows. Yeah. So I'm in the back and I'm talking to this guy and I said, you know, he's like, why are you here? I said, well, I'm really worried about Hawaii's food security.
Wow.
Why are you here? He's like, oh, I own a bar. I said, like, well, once the lockdown's in, I'd love to come get a beer. He's like, yeah, you can drink on me. And I'm like, what's the name of your bar? He's like, Sin. You know? And, you know, and they kept us back in the car.
You're going to the peripheries, Jason. I mean, you know, just like Pope Francis said.
Yeah. So I never got my free beer. I just want to make that clear.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
But I will say that, you know, I sat in the back of that car for 3 hours and I just prayed. And then I was in jail long enough to make my kids a souvenir. I made a rosary out of toilet paper. So I came home when they bailed me out. They were waiting for me. And
your kids will treasure that picture of you being arrested. My wife, I have a picture of my wife being arrested from years ago at a rescue, an abortion clinic. And my kids love it. I mean, they just, it's, you know, because it's like, here's somebody standing up for this. And this, you did, I mean, this is so much before most people, because now, I mean, there's been some movement against these stupid lockdowns and everything and all the rules and all that. And so, but that was early on. So that was great. So, okay. Well, I think
your wife's a hero. Your wife's a hero. Tell her thank you for me because, you know, those rescuers really changed America's heart on abortion because if you look at the polling on abortion in America, it was during that era of rescues where they came to understand we really believe what we say and then maybe what we say is grounded in truth.
Yeah, you notice there's a definite, America was just going the way of a lot of Western countries of just like abortion's just a normal thing. It's not even a debatable topic. And I really do think rescue changed that narrative. And that's why abortion still to this day is something that is debated and controversial. Yeah, we got a long ways to go, but it's not just this accepted thing in the background, like, okay, we just have it, so, which is good. So, okay, Jason, well, okay, let us know. Okay, so we have Hero, you have you write the stream a lot. Where else can people find your different work you're doing?
Well, my podcast is the Jason Jones Show. Right. movietomovement.com. You can find all of my movies, Bella, Sing a Little Louder, Crescendo, Voiceless. Divided Hearts of America just came out on Amazon and Redbox, wherever you watch movies. And then thegreatcampaign.org, that's really for Catholics. And you know, it's we as lay Catholics, now some of us just keeping your payroll funded. It's your business. You know, the pizza place you own is, it takes everything, and that's beautiful. But all of us in our own way really need to order our life to serve the vulnerable, whether it's our own, you know, our grandfather with Alzheimer's disease, or our niece who's a teen mother, or volunteering at our local pregnancy center. And that, so if you go to thegreatcampaign.org, you know, that's really our calling, is let's all in our own ways do the best we can to order our life in service of the vulnerable, who are, and at least in my case, they're smarter than me, stronger than me, wiser than me, more thoughtful than me. They've just been placed in circumstances that are very challenging. And so we have an obligation to stand with them.
That's great. That's great. And we'll put links to these different organizations and groups in the show notes. So, well, thank you very much, Jason Jones, for being with us. I feel like we covered about 1% of the work you do. So maybe we'll have you on again to cover some of the other 99%. God bless all the work you're doing. It really is a good inspiration for the rest of us.
Well, it's been a privilege. You know, Crisis Magazine to me is just, it's a landmark, and it's in the vanguard of fighting for the truth. So thank you.
Thank you. Okay, everybody. Until next time, we'll see you then. Bye.